You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about alcohol, mostly because I just finished Dry January, and it's actually the first time I've ever completed it. I've tried to do it like multiple times, and usually I get like a few days in and I'm like, well, if I'm not going to stop drinking forever, what's the point of just stopping for 30 days? And then I give up. But this time, I don't know what was in the water, what was in the air. I was just like, you know what, I'm actually very serious about it. And the reason why I even was serious about it in the first place is, firstly, I feel like my alcohol consumption over time has just gone up. And I wouldn't describe myself as somebody who has like a lot of alcohol every day, but I would have it on most days. So I'm not knocking back a bottle of wine every night or like multiple shots of whiskeys every night. But like most evenings, I would settle down on the couch and I'd have like a couple of measures of cognac, or if somebody was coming over, we'd share like a bottle of wine. But it got to the stage where I felt like it was like nearly every day. And I noticed it a lot more because my partner doesn't drink. So she probably drinks like maybe like 4 or 5 times a year. And I drink on most evenings, or I'm not saying most evenings, I would say like 4 out of like 7 days of the week, I probably would have had a drink. And so because she doesn't drink at all, or really, and I'm drinking a lot, it just makes me, or made me, like hyper-focused on the fact that I'm drinking quite a bit more. The second thing is that over time, I genuinely have noticed a cognitive decline across like multiple areas. My memory's been affected. My ability to think quickly has been affected. Even just like doing like simple mental arithmetics, I feel like I'm wading through treacle. I feel like it's a real difficulty getting to very simple answers. And then I also, and this one I'm not sure if it actually is related, but I think it is, my procrastination, like my get up and go, my ability to like have a to-do list and just get on with it, I feel like has also been affected as time has gone by. And typically, or at least before in the past, how I'd always explain away these things, specifically that like the not thinking quickly or losing my ability to like think quick on my feet, especially where maths is concerned, I would say to myself, well, I'm not a quick thinker, like I'm not a fast thinker, but I'm a deep thinker. And it's silly to say this because those two things aren't mutually exclusive. It's not as though people who think quickly aren't able to think deeply. Like you obviously exercise those two different skill sets depending on the situation. And the real turning point for me was like a few weeks before I started Dry January, my partner's brother was over and we were doing like this maths quiz from like this book that I got him. And out of that, like on the back of that, he asked me just like an off the cuff question, well, asked us an off the cuff question. And the question was something really simple. It was like if like a number, if like 750, £7.50 is 3/4 of a number, then what is that number? And my partner came to that to the answer like in 10 seconds flat. Whereas I had to really think about it. I had to be like, well, if you carry the one and you use division, and I was going around the houses basically trying to answer like a very simple question. And given that I have done maths at like all through secondary school, I did it at the highest level. I did economics for my undergrad, which featured, as you'd imagine, quite a lot of maths, really advanced maths. I also did some for my master's. Although I will say for my master's, which is also in an economic field, I didn't use as much as my undergrad. But for my undergrad, it was at least like 50% of my degree. So the idea of not being able to like work out what that original number was, like the 3/4 of a number being 750, what is the original number, it really concerned me. Like it was like the crystallization of things I had already suspected were happening, like just perfectly demonstrated in that moment. Outside just like cognitive areas or cognitive functions that I wanted to see an improvement in by doing Dry January, I also did it partly for weight loss. Like I wanted to see if I'd shed some pounds, because in my head, I'm like, well, if I'm drinking like 3-4 nights a week and I'm having, let's say, like 2 cognacs a night, sometimes 3 on like a Friday night or sometimes even 4, then if I stop drinking that, then I should be shedding like a lot of weight. So I did it partly for that. And on that front, it turns out I did not lose a single pound. And what I learned through that process of not losing a pound is that even though I drink my cognacs, for example, they're actually not that calorifically dense when you compare them to chocolate or desserts or crisps and things like that. And because I won't, if I'm drinking, let's say after dinner I crack out the booze, I'm not going to be eating after that. I'm not going to be having snacks. I'm not going to be having dessert. So it's sort of like I'm displacing the other food I would have eaten by having the alcohol. So that's why I don't think I lost any weight. Especially because having displaced that alcohol, I ended up having the dessert. So before I would have had a cognac, whereas I was really into apple crumbles this month. I also, maybe it's because my taste buds came back as well. I also had way more chocolate than I normally would. Typically, I really don't give an eck about chocolate. Chocolate could be sitting in my house for months and months and months and I won't think to look at it. Whereas maybe it was partly to fill the gap that was missing with alcohol. I found myself just eating a lot more chocolate. Not crazy amounts of chocolate, I'd have a line of chocolate, but maybe that also took over the calories that I would have not consumed if I stopped the alcohol and also didn't try to fill it with something else. So anyway, on that front, there was no successes to be had. Another reason I wanted to do dry January was because I'm an insomniac. I find it very difficult to stay asleep. So falling asleep is no issue for me. I can fall asleep in 15, 20 minutes, but I won't sleep for longer than 4 hours at any given point. There's the exception where I'll have, especially if I have a sleeping tablet, that's different. And so I have to take them because if I go weeks and weeks and weeks without getting a lot of sleep, then obviously, as you can imagine, the way I feel throughout the day becomes increasingly worse. So outside having to take the occasional sleeping pill, most of the time I'll have 4 hours continuous sleep. And then I might wake up for a couple of hours and toss and turn. And then I might manage to get another hour or two. So I thought, because they always say there's a relationship between alcohol and insomnia, or alcohol and it's not even insomnia, it's a relationship between alcohol and how deeply you sleep. So the RPM, your rapid eye movement, I think it is decreased when you have alcohol. So you're having a shallower level or shallower quality of sleep. So I thought if I eliminated the alcohol, then I might see an improvement in that department. And I will have to say, it didn't really affect my sleep in that way. The only thing I would say is that I felt more fresh in the mornings, because if I'm not having alcohol the night before, especially on the weekends where I would have more, then naturally the next day I am going to feel fresher, even though I'm having the same amount of sleep. By the way, I'm not sure if you can hear in the background, but my neighbor's dog is going crazy. I think they've left him alone, poor thing. So you might hear that come through a little bit. But the other thing that the not drinking for the month made me realize was it kind of highlighted to me what the people that I genuinely like and I genuinely enjoy their company. Because sometimes I feel you can actually end up being friends with somebody or being colleagues or being friendly with people, and you don't necessarily have a lot in common. You don't necessarily even like their personality. But what happens when you always socialize around alcohol, and I genuinely feel the older you get, alcohol plays such a central role in how you interact with people, because a lot of the time you'll meet up for a drink, for example, or you go to dinner, but dinner will include drinks, or you'll go to a function and that function will include drinks. So a lot of the time you never truly get to see the person or experience the person that you're friends with without the sheer or the without the veneer of alcohol. And what happens when you have the alcohol, most people become more tolerable, you enjoy their stories a lot more, you enjoy their companies a lot more. So the month of not drinking made me realize there are some people who I genuinely could talk for hours with, and this is mostly my family, my cousins and my partner and my other close friends. But then I also noticed there's some people who actually I don't like that much. I don't dislike them, but I don't enjoy their company. It's awkward to speak with them without the lubrication of alcohol. This was epitomized when I went to a friend's birthday party. And in typical times, I really like this person. I still like this person. But they invited me to their birthday party and I couldn't bear it. I couldn't stay for longer than 30 minutes because I didn't like the crowd. It was very blokey. A very laddie sort of party. I would say it was probably 80% men. And it was 80% like blokey men who were just not my crowd. I didn't like the ambiance. I didn't like the music. I just didn't like the vibe. And before, and by the way, the environment wasn't hostile at all. It wasn't like it was like a bad, negative, hostile. It just wasn't my taste. It wasn't my cup of tea. Now, before when I was, before like Dry January, what I would do or what I do in those situations is I just have a couple of drinks first. So I might have a drink before I even go to the party, which means I show up already like lubricated. And then when I get to the party, I'm definitely going to be knocking a few back. And so, of course, I'm going to enjoy whatever party I'm at because I'm inebriated essentially to a certain extent. And so the people I interact with, the people I meet, the friends I'm meeting up with are being experienced through the lens of alcohol. And when you experience things through the lens of alcohol, most of the time those things are better or improved. So in this particular situation, I realized like, no, like I do like that person. I still think that person is a lovely human being, but I just don't enjoy their friends. I don't enjoy being with them in like that context. And I probably would have like suppressed those feelings if I had been drinking. I also felt pretty like courageous. Like some of the time, even when you're aware that you're not having that great of a time, like let's say you go to like an after work function and you're bored, you're not having a good time, because especially these types of work functions where you can't be open, we're all just dancing around any important like topics and just talking about like socially safe things to talk about. We're not necessarily bringing our full selves to the table. And so that can render the experience like boring or mundane. So typically, I would have stayed at events like that. I would have been like, do you know what? I need to like stay for like a couple of hours just so it doesn't look bad, even if I'm not having a good time. Whereas like when I left that party after 30 minutes, I was like, well, I'm honoring my feelings, because ultimately, first of all, there's like 150 people at this party. So my friend's not going to realize that I'm gone, and he's not going to have time to spend time with me anyway, because he's spread pretty thin. And also my feelings matter in that situation, in that I'm not having a good time. I'm not enjoying myself. So why should I spend the limited time I have on earth at a party that I'm not enjoying? So I kind of felt like I would have used alcohol to deaden the feeling of being bored and feeling out of place. Whereas it kind of gave me the courage to just do what I wanted to do, to just sort of honor my feelings, which I kind of feel like also had knock-on effect in like other areas, like outside socializing. I just found myself like being more prepared to just say what I want or say what I don't want in a situation. The other thing related to the cognitive function that I spoke about earlier, which was the main reason why I wanted to even do Dry January, was that I found myself just feeling like I had better mental clarity. I felt like a fog had lifted. I felt like my memory was improved, because often sometimes I struggle to find like words for things, like simple words. You might be thinking about like different words to describe the same thing, and then you'll find yourself only having access to like one or two of the words to describe that, even though in your vocabulary bank you probably have like a dozen ways to describe different things. Or I would find myself not being able to remember like little things I did last week, or even things I did the day before. So I felt like things came to me a lot quicker. I felt like I had words at my fingertips a lot easier. I felt like I could recall things in the past, like even like longer than like yesterday or the week before, in a much easier way without having to try as hard. And I also felt like I had better emotional regulation, because I genuinely, because I don't tend to display like negative emotions. It's probably, you know, comes out of like being socialized to believe that women shouldn't show negative emotions. But most of the time, honestly, I won't show my anger. I won't show my frustration. What I would do is if something really irritates me, really annoys me, really angers me, I will like calm myself down by like, or pacify myself by having a drink. Especially if that thing happens throughout the day, I'll be like, well, it's fine. I'll just have a drink when I get home from work. And so what I found, even though you're calming yourself in the short term, what happens is that you're actually building up pent up energy and pent up anger, because you're never addressing those negative emotions. So you might go like a few months of never having verbalized your frustrations or verbalized your anger, or verbalized your stresses. And those stresses and anger and frustrations don't go away. All that happens is that they come out in like inappropriate ways. So like maybe your partner did something to irritate you and you don't say anything, you just have a drink to suppress it. But then guess what? Like the cat will do something the cats do, like meow, at a time where you don't want to deal with them. And then you'll find yourself getting like so angry and so riled up. Or like you'll spill your coffee on yourself on the way to work, and you'll get so angry in a way where it's just clearly disproportionate. And in those like micro situations where the emotion is disproportionate to the situation, I genuinely think it's usually because you have suppressed your emotions and it's coming out through that way. Like it's coming out at that time, but it's clearly not connected to that situation because those things are like micro frustrations, as I said. Like there's no need to actually display that kinds of emotions. So anyway, all this to say is that I found myself, one, being more hyper aware of when that was happening, and also realizing that in other situations I would have dealt with those small situations and bigger frustrations by having alcohol. So it was kind of good to learn to cope or learn to respond without the nulling or numbing effect of alcohol. The final thing that I observed during the dry January month was that I found myself having so much time on my hands, and not necessarily in a good way, because most of the time my routine would be, let's say, finish work, come home, and let's say I'll get changed, maybe my partner will have started making dinner, and I had even gotten into a really bad habit where she'd be making dinner and she'd bring me like a drink. So I'd be having a drink while I read like some stuff on the computer or like put on a show. And so when you start drinking in the evening, like your evening basically goes, it pacifies you, it relaxes you, and it basically makes you like really sedentary. Like you're unlikely to say, I'm gonna now start like doing my chores, or I'm gonna go do evening errands. You're probably not. You're probably like going to stay put for the rest of the evening. So without the alcohol, like you find yourself, or at least I found myself, not being able to tolerate that much TV, because I don't necessarily like sitting down for long periods of time without doing things. I feel like, I don't feel like I'm wasting time, but I just feel antsy. I feel like my body's not at ease. And so what I found myself is, I found myself just not being able to watch as much like TV in the evening. So whereas typically we might watch like a show or maybe a movie depending on what our mood is, or something on Netflix, I just felt like I didn't have the patience for it. I felt like I want to get up and do stuff. And then outside of that, I felt like the evenings and the days were so much longer, like especially the weekends. I felt like 24 hours felt like 36 hours. And so sometimes I would genuinely find myself like thinking like, what am I going to do to fill all this time? And it made me realize like how much time alcohol sucks up, especially when you're like socializing. Because I genuinely feel like, especially with like work socializing, I don't know if you need to stay like longer than an hour or two at most. Whereas when you're drinking, like you probably might stay there like 4 hours, 5 hours, maybe stay to like the early hours of the morning, because the alcohol like affects your perception of time and how you feel about that time being filled. So without that effect on me, I just found myself having like a lot of free time on my hands. And some of that time I was able to like direct towards productive stuff. Like I used to do a lot of essay writing competitions during my university days. And I picked that back up again. I submitted one essay that was like 3,000 words, where I just know I would not have done it before. I also found myself trying to fill the time by doing things like playing cards with my partner, as opposed to just like watching TV. Because I feel like when you're watching TV, doing nothing else, it's so such a passive way of passing the time, in the sense that like nothing else about your body's engaged. It's literally just like your eyes that are engaged and like components of your brain, but it really does have like a deadening effect on you, like in the sense that, you know, when you are watching a show on Netflix and they have this thing now where like the next show automatically lines up, it has like 10 seconds until the next show automatically starts playing. Same with like Disney Plus, I think, and other like streaming platforms. But in those 10-15 seconds before the next show comes on, you'll see yourself in like the black screen, and you'll just see like yourself just like watching the screen like a zombie. So I just found myself not wanting to be in that zombie like state, because I'm naturally, like I said, like very antsy and very sort of active in the way I want to be. Like I just find it difficult to sit still. Whereas with TV and with alcohol and TV as a combination in particular, I could sit there for hours watching shows and TV and movies and not feel the time passing by. So because I wasn't having the alcohol to pacify or to like numb my natural feelings of wanting to be like on the move or doing things with my hands or just moving about, I found myself just having less of a tolerance for just sitting in front of the TV, which was good because we ended up doing like more like mentally engaging things like Sudoku, as I said, with like the maths quizzes or playing cards or even just chatting on the phone, I feel like is more engaging because you're talking about different subjects with your friends and family. And, you know, I just felt like I wasn't wasting as much time. It wasn't like there wasn't as much dead time in the day for me. But it definitely took a few days to get used to having to fill your time because you're not filling it with alcohol and the effects of the alcohol once you've consumed it. So that was like the first part on just like my personal experience with Dry January. But the second half of the episode, I'd like to talk about the nature of alcohol and the nature of the way that we consume alcohol in society, mostly because I had a lot of time to think about this. And honestly, it's a question I've thought about or a subject I thought about in the past, because like I said, I have considered doing Dry January and reducing my alcohol consumption like many times before. So one of the things that I always land back on, and I have to say, I probably got this from Alan Carr's Easy Way to Quit Smoking. I used to smoke like a few years ago, like 5 years ago. It's actually my 5-year anniversary in January, like this January just gone. And one of the things that Alan Carr says about smoking is he says that nobody ever decides that they're going to be a lifetime smoker. And it's literally the same thing with alcohol. Like nobody, like when you have your first alcohol as a teenager, as most people tend to do in the West in particular, when you first like are with your friends and you have like your first sip of beer, because it's usually beer, or you first have like your first like vodka Blue Wicked, you know, like the vodka that comes in like those glass bottles, and they're usually like a bright orange or like a bright blue or a bright pink. Like when you first have those drinks, like you're having them in a fun way. You're having them to be like naughty or cheeky. Like usually like you've stolen the alcohol or you snuck it because you probably aren't able to legally buy it at that age, or maybe somebody older has bought it for you. And when you first have alcohol, like you're not thinking, I'm going to be drinking for the rest of my life. You probably just think you're drinking for that day, or you're drinking when you go out with your friends every now and again. But what happens is, like, literally most people who drink will find themselves like drinking forever. And it might not be to the level of like alcoholism, where it's like you're knocking back a couple of bottles of wine every night, or you're having like a whole bottle of whiskey by yourself every night. I'm not talking about extreme like medicalized alcoholism. I'm talking about just the nature of the progression of the consumption over time. You start out and it's just like giggling fun with your friends having a drink. Then before you know it, if you go to university or college, you have it like a lot of college. You have it like at least like a couple times a week when you go out, depending on like probably depending on your subject matter and depending on what kind of university you go to. For my campus, like it was La Vida Loca. Like I had a great time. Not my first time that I went to university, because I didn't actually complete the course, because I hated the course. But I ended up going back to university like a few years later, and I had the time of my life. And alcohol was a massive component of that. I went from like drinking every now and again when I was a teenager with my friends, like when we'd sneak alcohol could get access to it, to like at university, I'd probably drank like probably 3 weekends out of the month, probably sometimes in heavier periods, especially with debating. Like with debating, you'd expect it's a bunch of nerds who like don't drink that much and they're just sort of like debating. There's actually a lot of alcohol that's accompanied with debating, because after every competition, guess what? You go to the pub, or there's like a social event that is centering on alcohol. Or after the event, let's say if it's like a weekend event, like most people will go drinking or go to pubs or go to bars or go clubbing. So during my university days, like my alcohol consumption like definitely went up a couple of notches. And I feel like even when people don't go to college, the general progression when you go from like your teenage drinking to like your early 20s drinking to mid 20s drinking, it's the trend is always upwards, like for different reasons, but either way, the trend is upwards. And then by the time you reach like your late 20s and 30s and beyond, like drinking and alcohol is just part of your lifestyle. Like when you do your grocery shop, chances are you're going to put in a bottle of wine or two. Or when you have dinner parties, there's going to be alcohol on the table. When you go christen your child and there's a party afterwards, you're going to have alcohol. When there's a funeral, there's definitely going to be alcohol. When there's a wedding or you get married or your friends get married, there's going to be lots of alcohol. So the nature is that it just becomes part of your life. Like, adult life means that it becomes part of your lifestyle, like part of your lifestyle forever, not just something you do like once a year or a couple times a year on like quote unquote special occasions. It just becomes like a permanent fixture in your life. And honestly, one of the weird things about alcohol as well is the magic of self-deception that surrounds it, in that I genuinely feel like a lot of us are like functioning alcoholics and simultaneously are unaware of it, because like alcohol isn't vilified in the same way that other substances that like affect the way that you think and that have like an addicting effect are perceived. And so, for example, like I've got a good friend who, she came over a few months ago, and actually, why am I saying good friend? She's my partner's brother's best friend, and we live close to each other, so every now and again she'll pop in for a drink. And I just thought the level of consumption, and she's way older than us, she's like in her late 40s or she's like in her early 50s maybe, and she had quite a lot to drink. She had like, one time she came over and she had like 2.5 bottles, nearly 3 bottles of wine by herself. And I have to say, I was really impressed, because even though she'd had that much alcohol, like, she was like pretty sober in a sense that she could maintain a conversation. She was really funny. She was really engaging in general. And after she'd had like 2.5 bottles of wine, because I was keeping track because I was trying to actively reduce my alcohol at that stage without going the full dry January, but like, I just was aware of my consumption. So I was keeping track of like, oh, I don't want to have more than 2.5 drinks. And so I was surprised by how much she can drink and it not be like sloppy, it not being like she's stumbling around or she's saying crazy things or she's doing crazy things or she's like slumped over in the couch. Like, she was completely functional. But like, that level of alcohol consumption is not a healthy consumption whatsoever. It's not a, I don't know, I personally feel like it's not in the category of like healthy or normal or proportionate consumption, especially because it's like a random Thursday night at somebody's house where you're just like catching up. I feel like a lot of us are like that, or are trending towards that way, where we have like kind of large quantities of alcohol. Even I feel like having a whole bottle of wine by yourself a night, or in any given night, is like quite a lot of alcohol. That's basically like 6 glasses of wine. And it doesn't feel that way because often we're having it with food, or we're having it over the course of many hours. Let's say you start drinking at 6 when you're making dinner, and you might not have your last glass until like 11. So it's spread over a longer period of time, so the effects of it are spread out. But still, like, a bottle of wine by yourself is a lot of alcohol to consume. And so when I saw like my friend in that way, I kind of thought like, wow, like, I'm not too far from that. Like, in that situation, I was watching what I was drinking because I was trying to reduce my alcohol anyway because of the cognitive stuff I had observed. But outside being self-aware of alcohol, I definitely could put away a bottle of wine as well. Maybe not two, definitely not two, but I might be able to have like a couple of beers and like 3/4 of a bottle of wine. And I as well would not be sloppy drunk, or I wouldn't be inappropriate or slumped over. I would be completely functional. So I feel like there's a lot of people who are out there who are functional alcoholics, and they're functional alcoholics because they can still go to work and get on with their responsibilities and duties, can still be a wife or partner or mother or father, whatever it may be. But if you were to just look at the sheer quantities of what alcoholism is defined as, they probably like fit in that category, which is why a lot of us, like when we go to the doctors for like a catch-up or because we're sick, and they have that segment where they ask you if you drink or smoke, most people, when they're asked about how much alcohol they consume, they will like reduce it by like a couple of units. They might be having like 6 units a week. They'll say they only have 3 or they only have 4. And so that in itself is in like an indication that we kind of know that the amount of alcohol we consume is not healthy or not appropriate. And if we already have this low level of low-level feelings of shame around it, to the point where we're misrepresenting how much we're having to our doctors and GPs, it already tells us that at the back of our heads, we know that the level of alcohol consumption is at a problematic level. Now, I think like the biggest reason why we have, like why we continue to drink, or why drinking, one, is like an upward trend, and two, becomes like a lifetime consumption thing is I think we're literally socially programmed to view alcohol as being like the perfect companion to life's like every occasion. So like in the obvious sense, like whenever you see marketing, you see that alcohol is often associated with things that are positive. So like something exciting is happening, or there's like a celebration, or it's like a joyous occasion, or maybe like you're meeting up with friends, then alcohol is nearly always the accompaniment to that good time or to those good times. We're used to seeing that, but also in films and shows. I'm watching Mad Men right now, and honestly, I don't know if I'm loving the show. I feel like it's quite overhyped, but I'm gonna see it through till season 2 or 3. But whilst I've been watching Mad Men, one of the things that I've really noticed, especially because I'm not drinking some kind of more hyper aware of alcohol, is that literally every negative. So they have like all the positive occasions that are accompanied by alcohol as well, but also every negative like occasion is accompanied by alcohol. So when somebody in the show is like stressed, or they've got fear or worry or anxiety, or they're angry, or they're in a state of contemplation, or they're like plotting or scheming, then literally alcohol, especially like whiskey in this show, is always like there, is always present. It's almost like a prop in every other scene. I also noticed it in other shows that I watch. Like I love the show Scandal. I always Scandal, like if you've ever watched a show, you'll know that the chief of staff, like Cyrus and the president Fitz and other male characters, like have all at various times had like whiskey for all kinds of occasions. Like I said, for positive occasions, for negative occasions. And so it's deeply socially like ingrained in our culture, in our society, and we're socially programmed to think of it as like the coping mechanism or the companion, if you will, for life's like ups and downs. I will say like the only exception is probably like in teenage shows. Like when I was a teenager, I used to watch a show called Buffy the Teenage Vampire and other shows like that, and they didn't have alcohol for obvious reasons because it's targeted towards teenagers and like children essentially. And so in those kinds of programs you won't see alcohol, but literally for every other program and every other show, like alcohol often makes an appearance like several times throughout the season, if not like per episode. In Scandal in particular, I just had a flashback as well in that the men are often drinking like some kind of brown liquor, but the women tend to drink like red wine or wines in general. And often as well, like alcohol can be part of like a personality trait or can indicate something about the personality. So I'm thinking about like Olivia Pope in Scandal. Like she's supposed to be a very elegant, sophisticated woman. So you'll notice that the only alcohol they give her in the show is always like red wine being drank or drunk. I can never think what the right version of that is. Always being drunk or drank in a beautiful, like dramatic, like red glass, a glass wine. Or glass for wine. And then in other situations where the person is supposed to be like kind of like a tough figure or like a resilient figure, they'll have like other drinks like spirits. So thinking of like How to Get Away with Murder that features Viola Davis, who's my favorite actress of all time. But she, in her show, you will know if you've ever seen the show that her go-to drink is gin. And I feel like the reason why they give her gin is because it's not that she's not elegant. It's more that her defining characteristic is that she's tough. So it's like because she's tough and ballsy, like they give her like whiskey. And because like Olivia Pope is like feminine and elegant and sophisticated, they give her wine. So like the wine and the alcohol in general is not just used as like an emotional coping mechanism in these like shows and movies. It's also like forms part of the character development or the character personality of the person. And you can even see it in like whether somebody is like a villain or a protagonist. Like the villain will always be sipping on a spirit. Like you'll never see a villain being villainous, or rarely, outside like Hannibal Lecter. It's I forget what it's called, but it's about like that guy who like eats human flesh. But there's like a version on Netflix, or used to be on Netflix, where it features like this really sophisticated like British American guy. In that show, because his personality is like one of elegance, like the brutality with which, like he's a brutal character in that he kills and eats people, but he's also very sophisticated in his lifestyle. And so they give him alcohol, like they give him wine as the alcohol of choice. But typically in other situations where somebody is the villain, it's literally always like a spirit. And a lot of the time as well, like, we won't realize that a lot of these movies, like, their sponsors or like are alcohol companies or the alcohol industry. And so they'll be like very subtle. So not only is there so much alcohol consumption throughout the shows and movies, but there'll also be like very subtle forms of like a brand positioning. Like, you'll notice the way that they place beer bottles is to face the camera, even though there's literally no need for that. Or you'll notice that certain like whiskeys or liquors, again, the label will be facing either the camera like explicitly, or like the actors will reference the brand. And that's not like by accident. That's because the alcohol industry or that specific alcohol company has paid for product placement in that movie or film or show. So part of like the normalization and its presence in everything we consume visually, like in the shows and movies that we watch, is also just because of product placement and advertisement that's been really subtly integrated into the plots and character developments of these shows and films. So not only are we already naturally socially programmed to like think of alcohol as like okay to consume and accompany every emotion, but we also have like the amplifying effect of it being advertised to us like explicitly, covertly, overtly, like literally all the time. And the reason why like this is a problem or this isn't good is like, if it was like something where it was being consumed and it was like, imagine it was like, instead of alcohol, it was herbal tea. Ultimately, herbal tea is good for you. It's basically just water with a bit of flavor. Like, if it was being integrated into every aspect of our lives, into every emotional up and down roller coaster experience that we have as we go through the journey of life, like, that wouldn't actually be a problem. The only reason why it's a problem is because it's bad for us in all kinds of ways. I'm not going to talk about like the medical side of it or like the physical effects that it has on our brain and our bodies, because I'm genuinely not qualified to do that. But I have linked the episode the Huberman Lab had on the subject. It's really, really good. It's like 3 hours long. It's like really in depth, and I learned a lot about the negative effects of alcohol in the body through that podcast. So you can check that out in the references and resources links at the very end of the episode notes. But in terms of alcohol being a drug in general, you can tell that it's a drug, like, even outside being a scientist or a doctor. You can tell it's a drug because of the way it affects you when you consume it. Like, it literally alters the way that you think and your perception of like people, of situations, of the environment. It affects your eyesight. It affects like your hand-eye coordination. Like, when you consume it, you feel different. You feel a little bit out of control. You feel like, some people feel like it creates like an alternative personality. So whereas you might be shy and reserved and quiet in your everyday life, when you have alcohol and when you consume alcohol, it alters who you are and your perception and the way that you think and behave. And you might become like a loud person or like a gregarious person or like a person who's like the center of attention. So it literally has the same effect as like when you consume other drugs that affect the way that you respond to other people and the way that you behave. The other reason we know that alcohol is a drug is, like I was talking about earlier, like other drugs, the trend when you consume it is that it's upward. Like, your tolerance is always being built the more of it you have. And that's like a key characteristic of things that are addictive, like drugs, in that the consumption level over time is always upward. It's never downward or stable. It's always upward. You always need more to feel the same effects. So as a teenager, you might have had, like, for me, I remember my first time I drank like it was yesterday. I grew up in Ireland, as I might have mentioned in other episodes. And after school, we went to like a local like field like near my house, and it was very typical in those days to like drink in fields. And we went by like this tree we used to always congregate at, and somebody whipped out like some beers and they gave me one, and I had like, I drank it really quickly because they told me to, because we were playing around with it at that time, and drinking beers quickly was sort of like a game. So I drank like a third of it really quickly, and I automatically felt so woozy, but in like a really fun way, because I'd never felt that before. And so I only needed like back then I could get like crunk off of like two beers. Like, give me 2-3 beers. It used to be like a joke in my circle. Like, give me like a couple of beers and I'm literally like, I'm so tipsy. Whereas over time, what happens is you might drink like 5 or 6 beers and feel completely okay. Like you might feel giddy and like a little bit more like sociable and like talkative. And it obviously does affect you in that way. But you're certainly probably not going to be like drunk. Like, especially when you've been drinking for like 5, 6 years. If you're in your early 20s, you're probably not going to get hammered off of 5 or 6 beers. And for men, when you see the way that men consume beers in particular, especially when men are watching sports, or they're congregating together and they're having events surrounding sports, they can knock back like 10 beers and be okay, or knock back like 20 beers and be okay. Like their tolerance level over time goes like through the roof. So that's another component of like other drugs, in that you need more quantities to feel the same effects essentially. We also know it's addictive because it becomes a permanent fixture, as I said. It's not as though people like drink as teenagers in the context that they used to drink. So in my case, like maybe going to parks or fields and having a drink with their friends. And then when they're outside their situation, when they go to college or university, or when they get married and they start families, then alcohol no longer becomes a part of their lives because they're not in the same context or situations anymore. No, like alcohol often follows you from stage to stage, from like the different phases that you go through life. So it becomes like a permanent fixture in your life. And that's the nature of other drugs. Like most people who consume like coke, for example, unless it's like a once off, like maybe they do it when they're on holidays once or twice, like as young adults, like if they have it on any level of regularity in their earlier years, chances are they're going to be like lifelong dabblers. Like they'll have it at parties or functions or events, because again, the nature of these drugs, or drugs in general, is that they tend to follow you because again, they have like an addicting effect. The other reason why we know it's a drug is that, like other drugs, it causes cognitive decline. So like, you know, if you've ever seen interviews of people who've been like former addicts of various substances, whether it's cocaine or heroin or ecstasy or meth or whatever it is, one of the things that you notice is that it affects their cognitive ability. So it might affect, after long-term abuse, their speech pattern, the way they speak, or their concentration levels, or their recall or memory. And that's also the case when you consume alcohol at lower levels, but for prolonged periods of time, like you notice a cognitive decline. Like what I was saying in my experience, like I'm only 32, but sometimes I genuinely feel like I'm 50 years old or 60 years old, just because of the things that I mentioned, my memory issues or my inability to recall like things that happened like a few days ago, like quickly. And I maintain that that's the effects of alcohol, because I can eliminate other things that might be the root cause. Like one, I'm very young, so it's not like I'm experiencing these things because of dementia or other related like diseases like that. I also know that sometimes when you consume, like, for example, when you're somebody who consumes like lots of sugar and sugar-like foods, your concentration can be affected and your ability to think like clearly and for like prolonged periods of time can be affected. But I don't consume like sugary or sweet things, so I know that's not the case. I'm also like relatively healthy in the things that I eat and consume outside of like alcohol, so I know it's not like lifestyle factors related to my food consumption. And then like in other areas, like I'm a pretty healthy like 32-year-old. Like the only unhealthy thing that I can like think about that might be affecting like my cognitive capabilities is my insomnia. Because ultimately, when you don't get enough sleep, it means that your brain, and your body as well, but in terms of cognition, your brain isn't resting and isn't like recalibrating every night the way it should be. And so of course it's going to have some impact on your concentration levels, on your memory levels. So like part of it definitely can be ascribed to that or like put on that. But from all the research I've done over the years on alcohol consumption, the majority of it for me 100% has to be coming from alcohol. And I genuinely feel like with other people as well, sometimes like they're ascribing, like they don't know what the reason is for like little degradations in their cognitive abilities are, and they might ascribe it to old age or to like getting older. But I guarantee you, like a lot of it is also just based on like a lifetime of consumption of alcohol. Also, by the way, we kind of know this because even in the short term, we see like our cognition impacted. Like when you've had like a couple of drinks, like your clarity of thought is affected. You've got like a slower reaction time, which is why you shouldn't drive or like operate like dangerous machinery. Your thinking is also affected because your mind is foggier. And so if somebody was to give you like a maths test sober versus a maths test when you've been drinking, and even like low levels of alcohol, even just like two drinks, for example, your thinking is going to be affected. And so that they're like the short-term like effects. Imagine what the long-term effects are when you keep putting your brain and your body through that experience over and over again. It's like the logical conclusion is that there's going to be like cognition, like decline in your cognitive ability or in your cognition. So again, like all this points to the fact that alcohol like is a drug, and it's literally the only socially acceptable drug. I would say also maybe to a smaller extent, like marijuana or weed is also like kind of in a similar category, but like definitely less socially acceptable, which by the way, you should check out my episode on marijuana consumption. It's called The Magic of Self-Deception. It was like probably like 10, 15 episodes ago. But with alcohol being the only socially acceptable drug, you kind of know that because like there is no stigma around drinking except in specific contexts. So like the only time it's like socially unacceptable is when you're consuming too much in certain contexts. So for example, like you're supposed to have only a few drinks in work networking or at like serious things like a family dinner party or like a christening party. But other than that, like it's socially encouraged to consume alcohol. And the consumption of alcohol in certain contexts, if you think about it, is almost like, it's so bizarre that it feels dystopian in many ways, because in normal circumstances, we shouldn't be able to drink at work. Like you're going to your place of work, you're doing work for your company that other people rely on, that makes the company money, and you drink, you know, like if you were to replace the alcohol with any other drug, like imagine instead of like after work drinks or networking, like drinks, or I don't know, lunchtime drinks, like when you go to like lunch with like a client or go to lunch with your colleagues at like a restaurant. Imagine instead of having alcohol, you had like MDMA. Like instead of everybody cheersing with a glass of wine or whiskey, they're cheersing with like a pill or like a powder of MDMA or ecstasy. Or instead of wine, you're doing like a line of Coke, like just a little line of Coke with lunch. And the networking, instead of like trays of drinks being brought, like lines of Coke or like pills of like MDMA or ecstasy or whatever is brought, that would be an incredibly eerie, creepy feeling, even though like it's not that dissimilar. Like the alcohol has very similar effects to other drugs. Like obviously its profile is different in that it's more of a downer. Like most people think of alcohol as being like an energizer drug, but it's actually a drug that makes you feel lower, in that sense that it sort of like massages extreme emotions to make them mild. Like you might get giddy and laugh and joke and become more boisterous, but in general, like the way it affects you is it affects you as a depressant, whereas other drugs are stimulators. Like cocaine is a stimulant, and so when you have it, you feel more energetic and like energized and feel like you can do a lot more things. Whereas with alcohol, you feel like you want to sit down, you want to be relaxed, you want to like socialize in like a passive, relaxed sort of state. But either way, like the fact that it's acceptable or okay in professional context like feels very weird, because if you were to replace it with like any other drug, you'd realize how bizarre it is that we consume that drug in one, like work context, but also just in general that we consume it at such high levels in like various social situations. Because again, if you were to replace it with anything else, you would see how weird it is. I think one of the things that makes like our consumption of alcohol like socially acceptable or not weird or strange or inappropriate is because of all the rules that we have like ascribed or surrounded alcohol consumption with. And I think all those rules and like regulations like give it like a veneer of respectability. Like one of the rules, for example, is that you're not supposed to be messy with alcohol consumption. So if you're somebody who drinks alcohol and you become too emotional or hysterical, or you cause like drama and scenes, then generally you're kind of shunned. Like these types of people who don't respond well to alcohol or consume so much alcohol that they're like so dysregulated that they like show that alcohol is a drug are generally shunned. That's why, for example, when we see like drunk homeless people, we're shunning them because they're violating this rule of like, you can have alcohol, you just can't have so much of it that you're out of control. The other rule is, for example, in professional contexts, you're supposed, like drinks are supposed to be like served in like a mature quote unquote or like a dignified way. So you'll rarely go to like drink, like work drinks or professional drinks or drinks in a professional setting and have shots. Like there's no shots. You might have a double measure of something, but that will be like in a glass with ice, for example. Also, usually it's like wine and similar drinks are favored over beer. So like most functions that I've been to, like work functions, like they'll always have wine. They'll have red wine, white wine. They might have like some Prosecco or champagne to start with. And then like later during the evening, they'll have like a couple of spirits on offer. Like they might have gin, so you can have a gin and tonic, or they might have like some brown liquors. Maybe they'll have some whiskey or cognacs or bourbons. But that's like, you know, it'll be like mature or dignified drinks. Like you're certainly not going to be getting jello shots, like I said. Another thing that gives like alcohol the veneer of respectability is not just like the way in which it has to be consumed, like in a mature, dignified way, like I just said, and also like, you know, not having too much. I think also like they tend to be in nice surroundings where people are dressed well, like typically, and they're, you know, like they're not drinking in the alleyway or out of like a brown paper bag. Like if you're drinking in a work context, it's going to be at your office. It's going to be at a place where your employer has hired like a nice venue. And so there's an element of feeling like, oh, well, we can't be junkies because junkies have their drugs in the alleyways and they're doing it like in just like dirty conditions. At least that's what I imagine. I imagine when people are shooting up heroin, I don't imagine them like doing it in like their office or doing it in like a nice hotel. I imagine them like in bad situations, essentially. So because that's not the case with alcohol, again, it gives it the veneer. Like alcohol, where it's being consumed in like a socially acceptable way, I feel like that also gives it that veneer of like respectability. I also think that there's loads of social elegance rules connected to alcohol that makes it like acceptable and that almost makes it like a sign of sophistication almost. So one of the things I noticed firstly is that social elegance as it pertains to alcohol can be very gendered. So often women will almost exclusively only drink like wine, like red wine, white wine, sparkling wine, like champagne or like Prosecco, or outside wine will be encouraged to drink like cocktails. Whereas men, on the other hand, like most of the time when you see men drinking, if it isn't in the pub where they're having like beer, talking about in like more like elegant situations, they're having like spirits mostly. They're having like spirits like bourbons or cognacs or whatever. Or they might have like a gin and tonic, like a whiskey with like a mixer. And then if they are going to have like drinks outside of that, they might have like classic cocktails, like an old fashioned or a Bloody Mary. But it's not going to get much fancier than that. Like they're not going to have like overly sweet, fun, fruity, feminine drinks that are like colorful or like super sweet. And you're most of the time not going to see them having like sparkling wines. And so I feel like it is gendered in that way. I also feel like outside like the non-gendered stuff, I feel like there's a lot of ceremonial rules. So ceremonial rules in the context, like when you think about alcohol in the religious context, I think of alcohol, like I think of like the wine that's served in church. And there's lots of ceremony that surrounds that wine that's consumed at church. So the priest will go through the praying for the alcohol. So he'll pray over that alcohol. He might chant stuff. He'll drink a drink himself and pray some more. He'll hold it up either towards the cross or towards the congregation. And again, he'll like chant stuff or like pray over it. And then he'll wipe it with like that cloth that they wear around like their shoulders. Forget what it's called. And then the alcohol itself isn't going to be from like some second-rate mug or cup. It'll be in like this beautiful, like ornate silver chalice or gold chalice. And so when you go to drink like the wine, it feels like very special, feels very ceremonial, feels like almost like a holy experience because there is so much ceremony that surrounds it. In everyday life, to a lesser extent, I feel like a little bit of that ceremony is like also surrounds alcohol. And that ceremony or that ceremonial component comes through the rules that I spoke about a little bit earlier, through like the social elegance rules. For example, like the order of drinks, like you wouldn't go from a whiskey to a beer. There's an order you're supposed to have it in. You're supposed to have like a Prosecco or champagne to start, or maybe a cocktail, and then you'll move on to like wine, and then you might end the evening with like spirits. Or there are certain traditions, shall we say, that go around the kinds of alcohol that you consume with certain meals. So white alcohol will be served with salads and maybe fish and chicken, whereas red wine will be served with red meats. Or when you're having dessert, you'll have dessert with dessert wines. Or when you're having like savory desserts or like cheeses, you might have that with like ports or like other sort of like sweet dessert wines. Other like sort of like social elegance rules is even little things like how you hold the glass. So if you're having like a wine glass, like a white wine or red wine or sparkling wine, you'll hold the wine by the stem and not like the rim, which by the way drives me crazy when people do that. And you'll notice as well that waitstaff, especially in like higher end like places, they'll make sure never to touch the rim. They'll always hold the glass, like the wine glasses, by the stem. And if they're holding like a whiskey glass, or hold it by the middle or the bottom. In terms of women, there's also rules around like how you drink from the glass. So not only are you holding it at the stem if you're having like wine, which applies to everybody, but also like if you're wearing lipstick and lip gloss, you don't want to have like your whole rim of your glass surrounded with your lip imprints with like your lipstick, because that's unseemly, I guess. So there'll be rules around like making sure you drink from the same spot each time, so that you only have one lipstick mark at one place and it looks like more elegant. Or there's rules around, I don't know, like how many you have depending on the context. So the amount of alcohol that is encouraged to be had or socially acceptable to be had at dinner parties is very different to the kinds of alcohol that's expected or encouraged to be had at stag do's or hen nights. I also talked about the order of drinks, but there are also rules around who orders the drinks. So if you're at a dinner table, for example, like it's one of those things that's not said, but usually the most powerful person at the table, like most socially powerful person at the table, will be the one who like gets the wine list, gets the wine menu, and they'll be the person who chooses the wine for the table. Or if there isn't like a person who's clearly like ranks higher than the others in terms of like social capital or social power, then it might just be like the person with the most money, which again is a form of social power, social capital. And then if it isn't the person with most money, it'll usually be men if it's like a mixed group of men and women, because there's kind of like an assumption that they're going to be paying. So again, there's like, again, like loads of rules around it. There's also rules around like the order of drinks, who orders the drinks, but also like when to have the drinks. So like lunchtime is okay to have alcohol in certain contexts, especially if it's like a client meeting or if it's like a boozy like colleague meal. But you have to do like this little social dance where you find out if other people are drinking at lunch. So if you go to lunch and you say something like, oh, I think, I don't know, I might have a glass of wine, and nobody else says, oh yeah, me too, then you know that it's not going to be a drinking occasion on this situation. So then you'll subtly retreat. Sorry, that's my phone going off. So you'll subtly retreat and you'll pretend as though you don't want to drink. You'll be like, actually, no, I think I'll just have soft this occasion. Or we'll make sure that we only drink after 5 p.m. So like I worked at a place where every Friday at 5 p.m. they would bring out trolleys of like snacks and alcohol. And in general, there's a rule of like, you wait till it's 5 or 5:30 and then you can start drinking. And any time before then, outside like a lunch context, people kind of look at you a bit sideways, like you might have an alcohol problem. So all these rules around social elegance and the ceremony of alcohol, all of that I feel is designed, one, to control the amount of alcohol that people have, because again, if the trend is upward, then we have to have some kind of barriers to prevent people from just like drinking all the time. But also I think to make it more socially acceptable and to give it a veneer of respectability that other drugs don't have, we have to have all these rules around social elegance and all these ceremonies, these subtle forms of ceremonies around the consumption of alcohol. And actually, like I said earlier, like there are so many parallels between the consumption of alcohol now and the consumption of cigarettes in the past. Like cigarettes as well, like there was a time when they were literally socially ingrained or ingrained into like every aspects of society and every aspects of your day and every aspects of like different experiences. So they used to be considered as like being the perfect accompaniment to like every occasion, essentially. Like feeling happy, have a cigarette. You're sad, have a cigarette. You're bored, have a cigarette. You're celebrating, have a cigarette. You're worried, have a cigarette. You're nervous, have a cigarette. You're angry, have a cigarette. Like in the same way that alcohol now is like positioned as well, like I talked about earlier in terms of like the media that we consume, there was also like loads of social elegance rules around like alcohol, cigarettes. So for example, like also, there was some level of gendering in that slim cigarettes were considered for women, whereas like regular, like chunkier cigarettes for men, like nice lighters, like ornate, beautiful, elegant lighters were used as well. And I feel like, again, that's to add to the feeling that smoking isn't like this dirty thing. It's like this elegant thing. Also, back in the day, if you recall, when women used to have like those beautiful like cigarette holders where you might see them wearing a velvet glove with like that like cigarette holder, smoking like a really long and thin cigarette. Again, it's adding to that aesthetic and making it feel like a very clean, like elegant activity. Also, other things like how to blow the smoke. Like, you don't want to blow it in somebody's face. You don't want to blow it in like a huge puff. If you want to look elegant, you might blow it to the side, or you might blow it in like a small stream of like smoke as opposed to like a huge gulf of like smoke. Also things like I'm watching Mad Men right now, which, by the way, I feel like the show is somewhat overrated, but I will try and stick with it. But with Mad Men, one of the things I notice is that women are like, women when they're in the company of men, are their cigarettes are always lit for them. So they'll pull out a thin cigarette from like this beautiful gold holder, they'll put it to their lips, and automatically, without being prompted, like the men will go to light it for them. So again, like, it's like this tradition and this ceremony and these rules around cigarettes that obviously have gone now because the consumption of cigarettes has really, really gone down. But again, like, that ceremony and rule and idea that it accompanies like every occasion and emotion is very much like the feelings that we have around alcohol now. In terms of why I think people drink, outside like the programming, the social programming that I spoke about and the addicting effect that I spoke about, is essentially because people like the feeling it gives them. Now, before, I used to think the reason why people drink and continue to drink for a lifetime is because they genuinely enjoy the taste of alcohol. Like, they like the taste of their wine or their whiskey or their beers, and that's why they'll have it at all these social interactions or social functions. Now, I genuinely feel like people like don't like the taste of alcohol. And we know that because, one, when you give children alcohol, like, they have like the most honest response to alcohol. Like, 9 times out of 10, they think it's disgusting regardless of what you give them. Unless you give them like something really sweet, like a Tia Maria or like a Bailey's cream, which is basically like cream and sugar with like a hint of alcohol. Outside of that, if you give them like a beer or a wine or a whiskey or like any other spirit, like, kids find it revolting. I also feel like most people, when they first start drinking, like, don't like the taste of alcohol. It's something that they have to actively work to liking. Very similar to like the experiences or the experience of smoking. Like, if you're somebody who has ever smoked, when you first have your first ever cigarette, it's usually not a nice experience. It tastes like crap. It makes you feel funny. It makes you feel nauseated because it's choking off like your access to alcohol, to air. You also tend to feel very dizzy. People don't tend to like the smell of cigarettes when they first have them, and they also don't like the taste. But after they've had like 50, 100, 150 cigarettes, or they've been smoking for a few months, then that choke reflex like is overcome. So the first time they have a cigarette, they might feel like they're choking on it. After they've had all these cigarettes, like, basically that natural reflex has been nullified. Their taste buds have also been like deadened by the tobacco or the cigarette, and so they don't find it as gross as they did when they first have it. And then also they become used to the smell, because what happens over time is that you associate the smell of of like cigarettes, with like the calming effect you get from having like your need for that cigarette pacified, because we know that cigarettes are addictive. Like over time, people have a need to constantly like quell that empty feeling or that anxious feeling that comes with going for prolonged periods of time without cigarettes. So over time, you associate the smell with getting the thing that you need, which is like the nicotine hit from the cigarettes. And so it becomes like a positive association. And over time, you might even delude yourself into thinking that you like the smell. It is literally the same thing with alcohol. Like most people, when they first have alcohol, like don't like the taste. I've already talked about how when you give alcohol to children, like most of the time the children think it's nasty. But also for like young adults or teenagers first experimenting with alcohol, like their first drink is usually not nice to them. And that's why, for example, like when they have like vodka for the first time or first few times, when they have like whiskeys or whatever their like drink or spirit of choice is. And because they're drinking, by the way, to get drunk, often it is a spirit. They'll often mix it with something. They'll have it with Coke, or they'll have it with Fanta, or they'll have it with some other mixer. And the reason why they need to have that mixer is because they don't like the taste of the alcohol. And we know that because you never have to mix your orange juice, for example, with a mixer, because you like the taste of orange juice or apple juice. But because we don't necessarily like the taste of booze, of most liquors, most alcohols, that's why people need to have a mixer. And when people have been drinking for a while, what is going to happen is that they start transitioning to more like mature drinks, like alcohol or even unmixed spirits. And part of the reason for this, by the way, is because they've been socialized that this is what maturity is. Like maturity is having a glass of red wine or having a cognac. But the other reason is because they need to increase the percentage of alcohol in their drinks, because the more you consume over time, the more of it you need to have the same effects. And so the easier thing to do is to just go from like, it's just to go to drinks that have like a higher percentage alcohol. So over time, they transition to more mature drinks. And when they first start having those mature drinks, they also have to work at it. Like most people who first start drinking red wine, they don't actually like the taste of red wine. They just get used to it because of that positive association between the consumption of the alcohol and the positive feelings it has, like making you feel giddy or tipsy, or like you can socialize in a more lubricated way. And so you kind of like just kind of get used to it. You kind of become deadened or nulled or numbed to like the nasty feeling. And really, when people talk about like good wine, for example, or like high or premium whiskeys or spirits, usually what they mean is that those spirits or wines are smoother. And by smoother, I mean that you don't taste the alcohol as much. So like the difference between a smooth red wine and like a low quality red wine, shall we say, is because when you have the quality red wine, you're like, ooh, like you drink it and you're just hyper aware of like the nasty like taste of the alcohol. Whereas like higher end or more expensive or more premium like wines, you won't taste the alcohol as much. Like it'll be a smoother drink. Same with like cognacs. Like as somebody who's drank like a lot of cognacs or brown like liquors in my life, like more premium end ones, the older I've gotten, just because I don't want to have that nasty taste, is that you'll notice it goes down smooth. You know, you don't drink it and have like that sharp response or sharp effect of like cheaper alcohols or cheaper liquors or whiskeys or whatever it may be. Because again, the premiumness or the higher qualityness of it is defined by how less of the alcohol that you taste, which again points to the fact that most of the time people don't actually enjoy the flavor of the alcohol. They more enjoy the effects of it. All this to say that I now think that 99% of the reason that we drink and continue to drink is for the effects that alcohol gives us. It's like a social lubricant, as I spoke about earlier. It gives you the courage to like socialize without feeling self-aware or paranoid or self-conscious. It also like is like one of the very few forms of socially acceptable escapism, because it kind of allows you to bear or to accept, I guess you could say, like the mundane and the boring. So like most people, unfortunately, are trapped in work that is monotonous or boring. And they're going to be doing that for like the next like 50 years on a daily and weekly basis. And so whether you're standing up all day, like you're a waiter or a factory worker or a warehouse worker, or you're sitting down as in office work and just like essentially sending emails all day, either way, it's boring, monotonous, repetitive work. And one of the ways that people are able to do that for prolonged periods of time, because the average age of retirement is like 66 for the UK, I think it is. And it's probably the same for most like European countries. Then because you're going to be doing that for like 50 years, 50 odd years, the way to be able to stand that, to withstand that level of monotony and boredom and like repetitiveness and how much of your life it consumes is for you to have like regular periods of being able to escape that feeling, of being able to like feel tipsy, of being able to like feel woozy and feel like drunk and basically be like on a different realm for a period of time. And so because like that's like a massive benefit that people are getting from alcohol consumption, of course they're willing to, you know, put up with the fact that it doesn't taste as good or taste good most of the time, especially when there's no mixers, especially when the drink of choice is like a harsher drink. They're also willing to put up with like hangovers. They're also willing to put up with the fact that it has negative effects on them physically, like mentally, and in terms of like your liver, your heart, like your cardiovascular system, like all kinds of things. Like all of that is like a cost they're willing to bear, because like the effects it has on them, the ability to escape life on a temporary basis, on a regular but temporary basis, is so appealing to them. So genuinely, I feel like this is the core reason why people drink, and certainly is the core reason why I drink. Over time, what happens is that you delude yourself into believing that it is for the flavor, it is for the taste. And honestly, one of the first times I realized that that wasn't true was I went to a wine tasting event, but you know when you pay money and you go to a vineyard and they basically like teach you about wine and the production of wine and the way it's bottled and the whole process. So I went to one of those events, one of those things, and towards the very end, once we like walked around the vineyards and we'd looked at how the alcohol or the wine is bottled, they took us to the part where they show us how the copy is written for the wine descriptions. So when you turn over any bottle of wine, it'll tell you about how it's full-bodied, about how it's got essence of like chocolate and red berries, about how it's deep, about how it evokes like winter, you know, really full, romantic, like evocative descriptions at the back. So what I learned from that is that it's made up. Like for me, I used to think that they literally infuse the alcohol with like berries or with like chocolate or with like other flavors to create distinct flavor profiles from wine to wine. But it turns out like it's just somebody who takes a sip and they make it up. They make it up on the basis of what they think is going to sell. So like, it might literally be two bottles of wine collected at the same vineyard at the same time, bottled in the same way. And one of the descriptions will be like how it's full bodied and like dense and reminds you of like wooded forests. And the other one might have a description that tells you about how it's like lighter, about how it's like the perfect accompaniment to like lamb or whatever the description is. But either way, it's made up. Like there's no real, I don't know, there's no real distinct profile of flavor. It just depends on whatever copy they think they can basically attach to the wine that sells the most. So from that experience, I was like, oh, okay, so when I'm having all these different wines and I'm like swirling it around the glass and I'm tasting it and I'm trying to like see the description aligns with the flavor, it's like I'm falling into like the clever marketing that goes with wine and the wine industry. Like that's not actually real. And then that got me thinking about how I independently, outside reading the label, genuinely felt about each sip of the wine. Am I actually enjoying the flavor of the wine? Do I actually feel like it's full body? Do I actually connect to what the feelings they're telling me I'm supposed to have? And genuinely, most of the time, I didn't. Same with the descriptions with like whiskeys and cognacs and bourbons at the back of the label. If you stop and you drink and you try to think about how you genuinely feel about the alcohol, if you swirl it around in your mouth and you try to really, outside like the marketing and the emotional connection to the alcohol and the effects of it, if you try to really digest how you feel about the flavor, how it tastes to you, I guarantee you, you will find that it doesn't taste good, which will point you to the realization that we're probably just drinking for the escapism, for like the Dutch courage, for the social lubrication, for like the socially acceptable form of drug taking. And everything else is like clever marketing that, one, prevents us from really seeing it for what it is, and two, like allows us to consume it because it has all the ceremony attached to it and all this like clever marketing language and copies attached to it in a way that kind of stops you from consuming it in a critically aware way. Now, I had already kind of thought about these things before I went on Dry January, and honestly, it really amplified that feeling for me just because I was around other people who were drinking, and I could really observe in real time how that is what's happening. Like, people are having all kinds of different drinks, but the net effect of it, or the net reason, or the shared reason why they're drinking, is because they're drinking for the effects of it. That's why, especially the longer that people are drinking over the course of an evening, they can easily hop from drink to drink. It's kind of like one of the reasons why I realized that I was addicted to smoking was that sometimes, like, often people will say, like, I only smoke like one particular brand of cigarettes. So my particular one was like John Player Blue. If you've ever seen them, they're disgusting. And I only continued smoking them because it happened to be the cigarettes that I smoked as a teenager when I was first introduced to smoking. But what I realized was that when Jean Player Blue wasn't available, like, let's say I ran out over the course of an evening when I went to a pub or went to a club or I was drinking at a friend's house or whatever it may be, because for me, drinking and smoking used to always go together. One of the reasons I realized I was addicted was because I wasn't picky or fussy about what I smoked in the absence of John Player Blue. If I didn't have it, it's not like I was like, oh no, I only smoke John Player Blue. I can't touch anything else. It's like, no, it was like a drug addict, basically, where if your drug of choice isn't available, you will substitute it with any other thing you can get your hands on. So I saw that with cigarettes, and I also saw that with alcohol, and that people in the absence, like people who are drinkers, like real drinkers, in the absence of their favorite drink, it's not like they don't drink, they just drink something else. Or over the course of an evening, when you see people drinking, like when I was at that party, I saw that people just hopped around from drink to drink, especially as the evening wore on. Because ultimately, they don't, as time goes by, like, they forget that they've told themselves that they only drink because they like the flavor and because they like these particular drinks. And as time goes, as the evening wears on, you realize they drink for the effect. And so if one drink becomes unavailable, they're happy to hop onto another drink. And if only a certain set of drinks are available, it's not like they won't drink. They'll just drink the drinks that are available. Because again, they're not drinking for the flavor. They're not drinking for anything else. They're drinking because of the effects that the alcohol gives them. So anyway, it basically just reaffirmed those things that I had already thought about in the past when I've contemplated during Dry January before, and it just amplified that because I could observe because I wasn't drinking and my perception wasn't being colored and I wasn't like in that like realm of being off my face or being like tipsy or being disorientated from what's actually happening in the room and what I'm actually experiencing in real time. And so then I guess the million-dollar question is whether I am going to drink again. You know what? I will drink again. I'm probably going to continue my Dry January into February and March, just so I can say I've got a full like quarter of the year or full 3 months where I haven't drank, because I want to see if I continue to have those gains from like my memory, from like my quick thinking, from my clarity of thought and from my productiveness. So I want to just experience, because it's been a long time since I've gone like 3 months without drinking. I'm going to continue to not drink for the next couple of months. And then outside of that, like beyond March, I probably am going to drink, but I'm going to drink in the lens of like I'm drug taking, like I'm engaging in the consumption of drugs. I'm not going to be looking at people who do like MDMA or coke or other drugs and think that I'm in a different category, because I have been a little bit like, I have thought that in the past. Like even when I was thinking about my episode with marijuana, with weed, one of the things I thought about was how like my drug of choice might not be weed or marijuana, just because I just can't handle it. It has a terrible effect on me. But at the end of the day, like, I was drinking every other day as well. So it's not as though I'm not consuming drugs. It's just that my drug of choice is socially acceptable. So when I do drink, I'm not going to like have a holier than thou attitude. I'm going to see it for what it is, which is like drug taking. And I'm also not necessarily like morally or like philosophically against the idea of escaping reality on a temporary basis. Like, honestly, I think like life is so monotonous sometimes, and we're so trapped in like things we don't want to be trapped in, but we have to be because of like, we have to earn money essentially. So I'm not against escapism as a principle. So yes, I will drink. I just will drink with the scales having fallen from my eyes. So anyway, with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you were able to listen to the very end and enjoy the episode. If you did like the episode, I'd really appreciate it if you left me a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast from. It just helps people find the podcast. And if you could share it with a friend if you think they might benefit from the information or might find it engaging or enjoyable. I will catch you next Monday as usual. And until then, enjoy the rest of your week.